listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our regular conversation with Professor Luciana Bone focuses on the change from a socialist economy to a market economy in Russia, and the changes to the economy in China that have taken place over the last 30 or 40 years. Okay, Luciana, it's a pleasure to have you back, and this is a very interesting topic. We're looking at the best place to start is with the definition of terms getting clarified, and why not start with China as far as that goes?
Sure. We are going to talk, present a contrast between the transition to a market economy, a contrast between China and the Soviet Union in their respective transitions to a market economy. And the important thing is to look into how Xiaoping then in 1979 in an interview defined the market. So he, in November 1979, a year after the decision of the party to transition to a socialist market economy, there is such a thing. He said, "It is wrong to maintain that a market economy exists only in capitalist society, and that there is only capitalist market economy. Why can't we develop a market economy under socialism? Developing a market economy does not mean practicing capitalism. While maintaining a planned economy as the mainstay of our economic system, we're also introducing a market economy, but it is a socialist market economy. Although a socialist market economy is similar to a capitalist one in method, there are also differences between them. The socialist market economy mainly regulates interrelations between state-owned enterprises, between collectively owned enterprises, and even between foreign capitalist enterprises. But in the final analysis, this is all done under socialism in a socialist society. This is something Western leftists find very hard to understand or to appreciate. And they end up calling China capitalist.
Right.
Because it's acting in the market. So this is what the Chinese reforms starting in 1978 had in mind. And what I want to... So in effect, they enacted, China enacted reforms that would preserve the socialist character of the state and of the society. And to conduct these reforms, the Chinese Communist Party did not invite the guidance of Western hands. And also, instead of following the Big Bang model of transitioning to a market economy as quickly as possible, as the former Eastern European communist countries and Russia did, China took a gradual approach. And Deng likened this approach to, quote, crossing the river by feeling for stones. The contrast that I want to set up is, as briefly as possible, to go over the 90s, what the Soviet Union did, Russia eventually, did to transition to a market economy, and what China did. But briefly going over the Soviet story. Amusingly, I just got a message from a friend in Germany about a conference in Bremen, academic conference at the University of Bremen, where a participant was asked, does China actually do everything right? And the professor answered, simple question, simple answer. And the answer is yes. China goes ways that humanity has never gone. And that, with the speed and ease of change, I don't agree with the speed because they took 30 years, and that with the speed and ease of change that is only possible if the working people are actually at the heart of political, of politics, and especially if the system offers them social security for the future. So I want to argue that China's reforms, which took place in three phases, 1978, 2013, and 2017, strengthened the Chinese Communist Party as a political power and as economic planner. Whereas the Soviet Union's reforms, as we have talked in former conversation, dissolved the Communist Party as a political power and economic planner. The Soviet Union transition from a socialized economy to a capitalist market economy in a jiffy without setting up institutions, whereas China moved from what was an inefficient socialized economy for many reasons. China in 1978 had 17 state-owned enterprises. It now has zillions. Anyway, China moved from an inefficient socialized economy to a socialist market economy. You were going to say, Don.
Well, you know, it's interesting. In the Soviet Union, for example, I mean, it's difficult to say when the period of reform, quote-unquote, began, because we've been discussing, for example, that even the road to capitalism began with at least Khrushchev back in the 1950s with the denunciation of Stalin and, by implication, everything that had been done in terms of socialist construction up to that point. But it's certainly coming into the period that, you know, that began, You know, in fact, in 1991, you had in advance of that an abandonment of the leading role of the Communist Party in the society and in the government. So first of all, in essence, a bourgeoisification of the state, what had been a worker state, at least nominally. I mean, you can argue the essence of that till you're blue in the face with people of every persuasion. But there was no question that after the legislation was enacted, the Communist Party no longer controlled the state. And also, by extension, the economy, since the two were more or less unified at the top. So they walk into the whole, you know, marketization of the economy, we'll say, certainly the privatization of it in the Soviet Union and Russia, with the Communist Party out of the box before they go in. That the Communist Party still remains.
Actually, what you had was an absence of power and a competition among oligarchs. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, compared and contrasted with China, even now, while China has grown this, you know, economic megilla with market forces, with Western capital and its own capital and everything else that has people questioning its essence. Communist Party is still in the driver's seat and still very much integrated into the working class.
That's right. And it did these reforms in two steps. The first one was economic development to feed and attend to the needs of the people. And the second phase, starting with Jinping in 2013, was the restructuring of institutions, financial and economic and political, etc. So what we have in China is, first, take care of the needs of the people. Second, now that we have this 30-year experience practically with dealing with, you know, capitalist economies, etc., now we need to restructure the and clean up and organize the structures that are supporting this change. Do you see what I mean?
But yes,
anyway,
I do. Yeah.
We'll get there.
Yeah, and in addition, just one other point I wanted to make on that too. Even in Russia, you know, as an example of post-Soviet space, as the real, really the example, even though the Communist Party is not formally or even in fact in control of the economy at the pinnacle or of the state, it's well represented in both areas. And the relationship of the private institutions and the state, even outside of that condition, I would say certainly bears the legacy of relationship that existed while the Communist Party was the leading institution in the society. In other words, the people expect certain things from the Russian state that they've had for 80 years before. The state interacts with them. I mean, look at the popularity of Putin as opposed to the popularity of any Western leader at all. You know, that's based not on propaganda, unless it's some really good propaganda, but rather on the material relationship between the Kremlin and the population of Russia. And that is something that was flaked and formed not under the Tsar, but under the Soviet government and the Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
Exactly. You can consider the 90s as an attempt to erase the Soviet past.
Right.
And you can interpret the accession of Putin to the, want to call it power, to the presidency, the prime minister, you know, as a rollback of that intervention in the 90s. Because, for one thing, as you noted in former conversations, Putin set out to do the number one necessary thing, and that is renationalize the energy sector.
Right.
And so, yes, you're right. And of course, the reformed Communist Party, sort of nationalist type, commands 40% of votes, at least it did in 19... I mean, it could have won in 1996.
It actually should have won. There was severe meddling, which, you know, has finally come out. There were documents that were released under FOIL and such.
And under Clinton.
Yeah, Bill Clinton. Too. Right.
the Clinton Foundation released pretty damning evidence of Yeltsin asking for $3 billion.
And pretty much getting it. Yep, and pretty much getting it, saying, look, I need at least $1 billion to pay off pensions and to do this or that, or else I'm not going to make it. And as it turned out, he got the money. And the pensioners got the money, and he won the election, according to the people that counted the votes. And that's another question also.
Yes. I mean, the 90s was, So to elaborate on this contrast, let us go back to the, you called it bourgeoisification, call it the counter-revolution.
The same difference.
In Russia, in Soviet Union, and then Russia in the and elsewhere in the 90s. So by contrast to the Chinese Communist Party reforming themselves and then use the most wonderful, I want to say, the brightest economists, they were Chinese Marxist economists. They were homegrown. So China did not the Soviet Union accepted Western guidance, to put it mildly, and tutoring under Gorbachev and Yeltsin. And in the late 1980s, and massively after the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the dissolution of the Communist Party, an army of American government policymakers, economic and financial advisors, journalists, scholars, including evangelists, invaded Moscow. The idea was to create an elite core of experts to live in the former Soviet Union, help officials there run government and business. So in Russia, reforms in the 1990s decapitated the Communist Party, introduced capitalist economic reforms in their most lethal form, in the form of shock therapy, which devastated the population, so that the proper adjective for the policies that introduced naked capitalism to Russia is not reformist, but reactionary. And the noun for the process that enacted it is counter-revolution. So yes, what happened in the 90s was an attempt to absolutely reverse and erase the Soviet Union, a cost at whatever cost. So this did not happen in China. This is an important point. So then Clinton and Yeltsin, as we know, were buddies. Clinton wanted a vassal Russia. And this is what, of course, generates the hatred now, because this vassal slipped out of their hands. He wanted something like Poland. So Yeltsin needed, as you pointed out, American money to avoid a total economic collapse and therefore his electoral defeat, which Clinton didn't want.
Not to avoid, by the way, but to postpone until after the election. Because it wasn't that he was trying to avoid a total economic collapse, because a loan doesn't help you do that. What he wanted to do was postpone it until after the election.
Correct. Yes. Thank you for that. Yeah. So when Clinton raised plans, so for example, there was such a buddy, and this is another thing that we have to remember. When Clinton raised plans to expand the NATO alliance into Eastern Europe, Yeltsin didn't object. Right. Now, you know, the object was also to expand into Russia proper.
Right.
And they agreed that, in fact, they did agree that Russia itself might one day join NATO. So what's behind Russophobia? The vassal slipped out of the hands, and NATO is out of Russia.
Right.
Those two things are a slap in the face of all these billions and billions in planners that went in for 70 years before 1990 to destroy the Soviet Union. If you had Giulietto Chiesa on your program, the Italian journalist who was a member of the Italian official Communist Party and knows Russia inside and out. I think, remember, you had Giulietto Chiesa.
Long time ago,
Anyway, he And I posted this and circulated on my FB page. Long interview about what happened in the 90s because he was there. Yeah. And he said that the Yeltsin and their team and his team were not independent of their actions, in their action.
Right.
They made decisions based on advice and orders from the United States. The main decisions were written in Harvard and faxed to Moscow.
Right.
And they were written by Jeffrey Sachs, right, who, of course, had done a job on Poland. And they believed that the transition from socialism to capitalism would have been simple if their recommendation were applied swiftly. And all the Russian liberal economists were imbued with the economic culture and influence of the United States, so they were for privatization, the devaluation of the ruble, and all the other piratical measures. Now, I just want to read this this anecdote that Giulietto Chiesa, the Italian journalist, mentioned.
Mm.
He says things like these are never mentioned in our sources in mainstream. So he writes that in 1992, The Gaidar government, that's Yegor Gaidar, a young economist who was sacked by Yeltsin because the shock therapy policies that he applied threatened a revolution in Russia, a new revolution. So he writes that this Yegor Gaidar, who was the finance minister and something else in Yeltsin's government, had held a large meeting in Nizhny Novgorod in 1992, with several members of the reform team, that's the capitalist liberal team, neo-capitalist. It was the meeting between them and the so-called red directors, that is the economic and industrial leaders of the Soviet era, between 500 and 600 of them. Of course, they were called here hardline communists. So these directors tried to explain to these reformers, these young reformers who sat in the presidium, how the economy of the country actually worked.
Right.
They tried to convince them that they didn't oppose the changes in the system, but that it should not lead to the general closure of companies. They warned that there would otherwise be millions of workers expelled from production who would suddenly lose all means of livelihood, and that this would have devastating effects on the whole of society.
Right.
They were rather naive. They were speaking to the wall. They insisted that reform should not be identified only with privatization and that industrial production should be protected, at least within certain limits. And what was the response? Well, all those young leaders listened with hostility and contempt, Giulietto Chiesa says, invariably replied that the transition to capitalism had to be fast and carried out decisively, that there would be no difficulty, that foreign capital would arrive, substantial investment, that it was necessary to close the unprofitable factories, and I think, says Giulietto Chiesa, I think that the disappointment towards reforms and reformers began to produce resistance among the population
mm-hmm.
against the transformation, and this is 92, against this transformation. It was at this stage that the reformers themselves realized that millions of people react with protest to their decision.
Yep.
And they began ways to study to neutralize the possible uprising, which
right.
of course occurred in the fall of 1993. And Chiesa says it was the most immense popular protest he had seen. It was a gigantic demonstration. This is 1993.
Mm-hmm.
That literally broke the encirclement of the White House that had been set up by Yeltsin, and the popular fury was really great. The Moscovites at that moment expressed the general feeling of Russians, he says. They fooled us.
Mm.
In fact, the country found itself on the edge of the new revolution. So the revolt of the Supreme Soviet of the Russian Federation against Yeltsin was none other than the match that lit the fuse. And, of course, this was put down. Right. So if I may conclude with Russia, I don't know how much time we have left.
Just something I want to... While you're talking about Julio de Chiesa, I'm reminded that he was one of the first people to identify the creature Mikhail Saakashvili as a puppet of the West of Europe in particular, I think, saying that Saakashvili was responsible for the war. And you're referring to this class. And you're referring to this class of experts that were shipped over to the Soviet Union. You know, I'm going to channel Marx, you know, history repeating itself twice, first as tragedy, then as farce. Now the farce is Saakashvili is one of the experts that's exported by this group of clowns to help Ukraine fumble its way through freezing to death over the winter.
Can you imagine?
Yep.
Yeah. I just can't believe what has happened, you know, in the last, since the fall of the Berlin Wall. So let's do a tally of what happened.
Yeah.
A minor tally of the tragedy that these reformers, these Harvard linked, these reformers did to Lenin's Russia, to Stalin's Russia, to... Yeah, you're right. It began with Khrushchev.
Yeah.
Anyway, by 1993, between 39% and 49% of the population was living in poverty. Life expectancy dropped for men from 64 to 57.
Yeah, that was inside of 3 years.
Yep.
That means a lot of people died, a lot.
Yeah. Women dropped from 74 to 71, 3 years. Okay. Alcohol-related deaths skyrocketed.
Yep.
60%, I'm rushing here. Alcohol-related deaths skyrocketed 60% in the 1990s.
Mm.
And this is also significant. Deaths from infectious and parasitic diseases shot up 100%.
Yep.
This is the first thing that Stalin's 30s tackled, infectious diseases. So, and they were eliminated. Now, by 1996, 10% of the population owned 90% of the national income.
Yep.
And, of course, we know other consequences, racketeer, black market, murders, robbery, prostitution.
Right, gangsterism.
Et cetera. Now, the only one shocking statistics that I didn't mention, I think I mentioned it before, is that the estimate by the medical journal, the famous medical journal in England, the estimate of deaths related to this Big Bang transition to capitalism is estimated to have been 10 million throughout the Soviet Union and 7 million in Russia.
Yeah. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
Isn't that's what they blamed. They claimed Stalin killed millions of people in the transition from feudalism to a modern economy, and yet this was done right under our nose with our tax dollars, no less. And it's a fact that this happened.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a fact of propaganda. It's a fact.
Right. That's right. It's not a controversy at all. Well, you're talking about like the medical journals are reporting it in the West.
The Lancet. Yeah. Well, the Lancet is the granddaddy of medical journals. In Britain. Yes. And go on. Sorry, I interrupted you. I remember the name, the Lancet medical journal.
That's all. That's all I'm wondering.
It's the one that quoted that tallied the 10 million related deaths to shock therapy.
That's a lot. And 7 million inside of Russia, and Russia has a population of about 150 million. So you're talking about somewhere around 5% of the population died.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's a remarkable number.
That's it. So I would like, you know, the point of actually you are talking about this contrast is, please think twice before you call China capitalist.
Mm, please, yeah.
Okay, because a contrast is enormous, and I'm going to go into this, and if we can't finish today. We'll finish.
Yeah,
next time.
We have 2 minutes from right now. So.
Okay. So, first of all, the Communist Party of China did make real reforms, but they were gradual, as I said, and they proceeded from 1978 to 2017. So the first step under Deng was economic development, as I mentioned, to improve livelihood. And the second step was the three reforms, administrative, legislative, and financial, of under Xi in 2017. Yeah, that was the big Congress.
He
reformed the institutions to accommodate for the economic development. In the opinion of many, the reforms in China secured and preserved the path to socialism, while the reforms in the Soviet Union destroyed the path to socialism. Not totally.
Right.
Thank goodness.
Right.
Okay, so these reforms and open door policy of China began with the adoption of a new economic development strategy at the third plenary session of the 11th Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party in late 1978, under, of course, the leadership of Deng Xiaoping. What he said in 1978 was, failing to adhere to socialism, to carry out reform and opening up, to develop the economy and to improve people's livelihoods, can only lead up to a blind alley. The basic line governs 100 years and must not be shaken. The basic line. Again, a contrast to what happened in the Soviet Union. The basic line would be that of the Chinese Communist Party.
We're going to have to come back to this next week. And thank you very much, Luciana. We'll speak with you again then.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. It took a quarter of a century since the collapse of the Soviet Union for the issue of inequality to resurface at the center of political and economic debates, this time in the West. Some would even argue that it has already sparked a populist revolution, culminating for now with the Brexit vote and the election of Donald Trump. Will the Western quest against inequality be more successful than the Soviet one? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Jason Hickel, anthropologist at the University of London and author of The Divide, A Brief Guide to Global Inequality and Its Solutions. Dr. Hickel, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you know, I come from a country which for 70 years had run a massive experiment in eradicating inequality. And many people here in Russia believe that this fixation on inequality ultimately made the Soviet system incompatible with reality. To what extent the opposite is true? If you abandon any regulation and leave it all to the market forces, can you have a harmonious, well-functioning society?
Yeah, I think it's quite clear that extreme inequality has become a very serious problem around the world, both within countries as well as between them. And what's evident is that it's creating not only economic crises, but also political ones, in the sense of richer people are able to control political outcomes more easily, and poor people feel deeply disenfranchised and disaffected with the dominant system. So I think that it's quite important that we seek to address this problem as urgently as possible.
Well, I'm not trying to draw any direct comparisons between the Soviet focus on inequality and the Western one, but I wonder if you see any historical continuity between the collapse of the Soviet Union and the triumph of neoliberal economics back in the early 1990s and such a sharp rise of inequality a quarter of a century later.
Yeah, so I think it's quite clear that with the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s, then there was a kind of ideological consensus around neoliberal globalization, and that was that carried on through the 1990s and is still with us today. And the consequence of that, sort of the imposition of free market globalization, has been a dramatic increase in inequality since the 80s and 90s, which has really reached kind of catastrophic, historically unprecedented levels. And so when we call for a reduction in inequality in Western societies, for example, it doesn't need to be the kind of dramatic, aggressive attempts to equalize that we might imagine the Soviet Union attempted. Rather, we're just calling for the kind of reduction in inequality that was accomplished, in fact, in Western societies like the US and Britain during the post-war years, during the 40s and 50s and 60s, before the onset of neoliberal globalization.
I think you would agree that inequality is often presented as a kind of a leftist preoccupation, and the typical response to this kind of criticism is that inequality is natural. Look at the Pareto distribution or the Matthew principle. A large portion of wealth, resources, talents, what have you, has a tendency to be concentrated in the hands of a small minority, and yet your argument, from what I understand, is that this kind of inequality that we observe in the world today is not natural. It is deliberately constructed. It is consciously maintained. Do I understand you correctly?
Yeah, that's right. That's the argument that I advance, is that there's nothing natural about inequality. On the contrary, it's been effectively deliberately produced because the economic system is designed in such a way so as to siphon the vast majority of resources and value in the economy up to a small elite at the expense of most of the rest of the people, right? And we can see that happening very clearly now, where if you look at wages in the U.S., for example, they've been in real terms stagnant since the 1970s, whereas the incomes of the top 1% have effectively skyrocketed, mm-hmm. Many times what they used to be. And that's as a consequence of deregulation, as a consequence of an attack on unions, as a consequence of deindustrialization, outsourcing of labor to poorer countries, breaking the back of unions, and a reduction of the tax, of the top marginal tax rate on the richest incomes.
You mentioned some of the statistics, and I think the most stunning statistics, as far as I'm concerned, comes from Oxfam, which suggested last year that the world's 8 wealthiest individuals now own as much as the 3.6 billion people who make up the poorest half of humanity. That disparity is very hard to comprehend, but do you think that's the limit?
Yeah, it is difficult to comprehend. I mean, it's an extraordinary, again, almost unprecedented extent of inequality to imagine. And do I think it's the limit? No, I mean, it's clearly continuing to head in this direction. Despite all the talk about inequality that we've heard since the global financial crisis in 2009 and the rise of Occupy Wall Street in 2012, it's clear that no, you know, real substantive change has been made to economic policy to make it fairer for the majority of people, not just in countries like the US and in Western Europe, but also around the world. And which is shocking because we know precisely what allows for a reduction in inequality, giving workers more bargaining power, improving minimum wages, more progressive taxes on top incomes. It's not rocket science. We have very clear policy options on the table.
Now, I know that some of the policy options you suggest also include not only a global minimum wage, but also putting a maximum cap on income and wealth. And as somebody who was born in the Soviet Union, where redistribution was the bedrock of economic policy, I think you would inevitably run into the question of motivation. If you proceed with guaranteeing or limiting people's incomes, wouldn't you also strip from the sense of agency, the entrepreneurship, the initiative?
So the argument for a global minimum wage, I think, is more or less rock solid. It's there's nothing really radical about that. We have minimum wages in most countries, and as long as we have a system where capital has the ability to flow freely around the world, then it makes sense that similarly we also globalize the protections that are necessary to ensure that workers get a fair share from the economy. So there's nothing radical about a global minimum wage. It can be implemented very easily simply by pegging a minimum wage in each nation at, say, 50% the nation's median, so that it fluctuates depending on the fortunes of the nation, and so that there's no massive disruption to comparative advantage. It's something that the International Labour Organization and the UN could do relatively easily.
You don't stop there, and you actually propose some sort of a cap on the income. And I think to that, many people would say, or many wealthy people would say, that in many countries, wealthy individuals do invest in charity. People like Bill Gates do amazing work around the world. And if those individuals manage to accumulate that much money, wouldn't they be more knowledgeable about how to spend it compared to the governments, let's say?
So I actually haven't proposed a cap on incomes, although it's an idea that I'm sympathetic to. I think again, it's not a radical policy proposal in the sense of, if you look at the United States, even during the post-war years, the top marginal tax rate was about 90%+. Okay, so which is effectively a cap on top incomes. So I mean, you can earn above a certain level, a certain very high level. But the vast majority of that excess above that level will go back to the state and be redirected into social spending on, you know, decent healthcare, education, public housing, et cetera, which again, capitalist countries in the West, including Britain and the United States, had redistributive policies like that in the post-war decades up until the 1980s when all of that was dismantled. And so it's truly not radical to ask for kind of, at the very least, a return to those, those fairer, more meaningfully distributive policies of the past.
I guess the point I was making is that those wealthy individuals, the wealthiest individuals that we know of, they already invest in numerous social causes, so be it space exploration or eradication of malaria. They're already involved around the world. Isn't it a better idea to let them do that on their own accord rather than, getting some resources forcefully from them and putting them in the hands of governments, which you don't know how they would be using those resources. How effectively they would be using those resources.
I think the key principle here is that we want that kind of wealth to be democratically accountable, right? And if it's in the hands of billionaire philanthropists, there's really no way that we can have a say in how it's in how it benefits society, right? Whereas at least with governments, hopefully they're democratic governments, in which case we can have an actual say on how the yields of the wealth in our economy is directed. So I think that's, again, it's more democratic to have it in the hands of a kind of accountable democratic body than it is to have it in the hands of billionaire elites. We have no idea what they're doing with it. So maybe they do some good things, but another key problem here is that the very process by which billionaires accumulate their money, right, quite often is destructive to other people's lives. So if you look at Bill Gates, for example, he has done a lot to address key public health concerns, but at the same time, much of his money is made from intellectual property regimes that he's helped press through the World Trade Organization, which have actually made it very difficult for poor people in poor countries to access the medicines that they need to live.
Now, you mentioned poor countries, and I think one of the most unsettling conclusions in your research is that it's not rich countries who are helping poorer countries to develop, but actually vice versa. You're making the point that whatever goes into the developing countries in the form of loans or aid often comes back multiplied. How does it work?
Yeah, so it's quite clear to us that during the colonial period, the world economic system was organized in a way that effectively siphons, resources and value from the periphery of the world system, the global south, into the core of the world system, Western Europe, etc. And we might imagine that in the post-colonial era, that no longer operates, but in fact, it's not true. In fact, today, to this day, according to the most recent data that we have, the global south is a net creditor to the global north. More money flows from south to north than goes the other direction. And that includes all money, not just aid, foreign direct investment, but also, loans, et cetera. So, the flow is extraordinary in size. So the global south receives about $2 trillion US dollars per year from the north. But at the same time, about $5 trillion flows the other direction. So the South is a net creditor to the North in the region of $3 trillion U.S. dollars per year. If you compare that to the aid budget, just for arguments, for every dollar of aid that the South receives, they lose $24 in net outflows to the North. And so really, it disrupts this narrative that we have that the global North is sort of this benevolent giver of aid to the South, when in fact, the way that finances flow around the world is completely the opposite. Effectively, the South is developing the North, and has been doing so since at least the onset of colonialism 500 years ago.
I wonder, though, if countries are the right level of analysis here, because it seems that you are talking really about private interests wrapped up in the flag and perhaps being assisted by national actors and national bureaucracies rather than national interests. Is it really a poor country versus a rich country, or more like a businessman from a rich country taking advantage of a poor country with the help of his country's bureaucracy?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you look at some of the major financial flows, some of it is in the form of debt repayments. Okay, so some of that is to private lenders. Most of it is to the World Bank and the IMF and state creditors. Okay, so the Global South sends about $200 billion per year in interest payments on foreign debts alone, which itself outstrips the aid budget. Okay, if you also look at illicit financial flows, the Global South loses about $1 trillion U.S. dollars per year in illicit financial flows that go mostly to tax havens that are governed by rich countries, like the City of London, for example. So, which again dramatically outstrips the aid budget. So, of course, I mean, it's true that's happening because of private multinational companies that are effectively evading taxes in Global South countries by shifting it into tax havens. But what's crucial here is that that's only possible because of the structure of the global economy enables it to be so, right? I mean, this is because of WTO rules on trade. This is because of the tax haven system, which is controlled by Western governments. And so on. So yes, it's true that many of these flows happen between private companies and private individuals, but it's the architecture of the global economy that's really at stake here, and that's what we need to examine when we think about why poor countries remain poor and how rich countries continue to get so rich.
Well, Dr. Hickel, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Jason Hickel, anthropologist at University of London and author of The Divide, a brief guide to global inequality and its solutions. Dr. Hickel, before the break, I think you sounded somewhat skeptical of the aid paradigm. And I also saw in some of your articles that you believe that this narrative it's kind of exploitative of empathy and the better angels of our nature, so to say. You even wrote that it makes the takers seem like givers, granting them a kind of moral high ground. I wonder if you personally encountered any pushback for saying that the do-gooders are not as selfless as they would like to appear.
So I have a lot of sympathy for do-gooders. I mean, I used to be involved in the development industry myself. And I think it's fantastic, that this sense of compassion that people have that leads them to try to help people who are suffering and so on. But the important thing I want to emphasize here is that quite often that effort is misdirected in the sense that it fails to address the actual structural drivers of the concerns that are at stake here, right? And so if you take global poverty, for example, it might seem like a reasonable thing to go to, say, Ghana or Honduras and set up an orphanage, drill a well and so on. I mean, I celebrate that. That's fantastic. But ultimately, it's not solving the structural problem at stake, which is the fact that we have a global economic system that is fundamentally designed in a manner that siphons wealth and value from the periphery, into the core, the global north.
You seem to be attributing that only to structural reasons. But if we look, for example, at Afghanistan, the country that's been reliant on aid for many decades already, if you see the structure of that aid, a lot of that money goes into consultancy fees and private contracts. So do you think there's any private interest involved in helping the world's poor?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that the aid industry is a booming business. And most of the, well, a good deal of the yields from the aid industry end up going back to private companies in the West, or even local private companies, without really addressing the key needs that they seek to address in the first place. But I really do want to emphasize, you know, the importance of thinking about the way the global economy is structured. Because if you think about, you know, simply the way that voting power works in the key institutions of global governance, right? Take the World Bank and the IMF. Okay, these are key institutions in determining macroeconomic policy around the world. The U.S. has a veto power over all major decisions. And a small handful of wealthy countries basically control most of the vote. The Global South, which has 85% of the world's population, has less than 50% of the vote in these key institutions of macroeconomic governance. So even if the majority of the world got together and disagreed with a policy that they impose, say structural adjustments, you know, privatization, whatever it might be, they would not be able to resist because that's the way these institutions have been designed. There's a kind of global apartheid that's right at the center of the way that the global economy is organized that we're not actually addressing effectively. Okay, and the same is true of the World Trade Organization. In the World Trade Organization, there's a kind of one country, one vote system. But in fact, in reality, countries with larger economies have much more bargaining power and almost always get their way. Countries with smaller economies can do very little to stop the policies of their counterparts from being railroaded through. And so again here we see a kind of a fundamental lack of sovereignty that Global South nations have when it comes to determining their own economic policies.
Mm-hmm. Now, I sense you are not a very big fan of Donald Trump, and yet one of his consistent grudges is against the World Trade Organization and numerous international institutions. He seems to be very unhappy with the IMF. He seems to be very unhappy with the existing aid paradigm. As much as you may dislike him personally, do you ever catch yourself agreeing with him?
So Donald Trump's critique is really bizarre to me because he has been arguing that things like, you know, free trade agreements like NAFTA or whatever it might be, the World Trade Organization, the IMF, et cetera, are somehow bad for the United States, unfair to the United States. And in fact, the reality is completely the opposite. The U.S. has benefited tremendously economically through the clout that it wields through the World Bank and the IMF, effectively giving it the power to impose structural adjustment on Global South countries over the 80s and 90s with immense benefit to American corporations. NAFTA has been a tremendous benefit to American corporations. So Trump fundamentally doesn't understand how these are useful tools of U.S. imperialism, in fact, right? So it's not clear to me what his gripe is. I mean, it's true that these institutions are deeply unfair, but they're not unfair to the U.S. They're unfair to the majority world, to the Global South. And that's really the reason we need to reform them.
But regardless of how Mr. Trump arrives at his conclusions, do you think him putting pressure on those existing international framework, the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, with their very skewed powers, as you mentioned, do you think he may help address some of the imbalances and injustices that you have been writing about?
On the contrary, I think that it's having exactly the opposite effect, right? Because what's happening is that as Trump attacks these multilateral institutions, progressives come out of the woodwork to defend them, bizarrely. You know, let's shore up the IMF. Somehow the IMF is the hero. The World Trade Organization is the hero because they're bastions against Trump or something like that, because Trump dislikes them. And so there's been a withering of the progressive critique of these institutions because it's been taken up by someone whose argument is sort of very unclear, right? So you know, there's really no reason for us to go about defending these institutions simply because Trump is attacking them. Trump's arguments are irrelevant. The point is that what remains is these institutions are unfair, not to the U.S., but to the majority world. And that's what we need to address.
Mm-hmm. One thing that, I'm sorry for continuing with this Trump angle, but I think one thing that you guys share is skepticism of the notion of green growth, this idea that humanity can continue boosting its GDP without expanding its toll on the environment. And Trump's strategy here is to pursue growth with very little concern for the environment. I think you're proposing the exact opposite, abandoning growth goals and pursuing the environment. Am I misstating your argument?
No, that's right. So since 2012, there's been this expansion of this interest in the idea of green growth, the idea that we can continue growing forever, right, as long as we can find ways of decoupling environmental impact from GDP growth. But in the years since 2012, when this idea was first sort of mooted, We've had a number of studies showing that this is empirically, the empirical evidence for this doesn't exist, okay? And the models that we have projected into the future show that it's quite clear that green growth is not really possible. Especially, you know, if we consider the fact that we're already in an era of ecological overshoot, in terms of resource use, in terms of climate change, in terms of biodiversity loss, we're facing an ecological emergency right now. And the main driver of that is the expansion of our economic activity, is GDP growth. And so we need to fundamentally rethink our dependence in rich countries on GDP growth, because pursuing this exponential expansion of economic activity is going to quickly drive us to the point of a kind of uninhabitable planet, incompatible with the continuation of human civilization. So what I argue for in my work is that we need to shift our economies away from a dependence on endless exponential GDP growth towards a kind of steady state where we're able to improve people's lives, but without focusing on expanding GDP and all of the destructive entailments that that has.
Well, you've also suggested a pretty radical solution to climate change, and that is opening borders to climate refugees. You argued that only when rich nations finally start to feel the heat, so to say, and are forced to deal with the climate consequences of their policies, will they act fast? In your own calculus, what are the chances of that happening?
So the article that you're citing was meant to be a provocation, the idea being that if you look at the major contributors to historical emissions, they are rich countries like the US, Western Europe, etc. But the vast majority of the damage from climate change is happening in the global south. Okay, so 98% of the deaths that occur due to climate change each year happen in the global south. The global south loses about $500 billion per year in costs associated with climate change, which is vastly more than the global north suffers. So the real effects of climate breakdown are happening in the global south. But the problem is that that the global north has no real sense of that issue, right? Because it's happening elsewhere, right? So my provocation was that if there was free movement of people, then people who are in affected areas, deeply affected areas, if they were able to move towards safer areas, which happened to be in the global north, it would force a kind of reckoning in the global north that, look, our contributions to climate breakdown are causing mass chaos and disruption, and we need to urgently do something about it. So it wasn't so much a proposal, although I do believe in open borders, as a provocation to force the point that we need to face up to the fact that the causes and consequences of climate change are on opposite sides of the border.
Mm-hmm. Now, I also want to ask you the question about the United Kingdom, where you're based right now, because you mentioned before the structure of the global economy allowing the exploitation to take place and fostering those inequalities. And for many years, the United Kingdom has been allowing illicit funds from foreign countries to come into the United Kingdom. It has changed its policy of late, and there is now a new legislation allowing for the possible seizure of opaque foreign wealth. Do you think the authorities in the West, or in the UK in particular, are finally serious about putting an end to this practice?
I see that as a very small measure compared to the scale of the problem, right? So what really needs to happen is that the status of the City of London needs to be fundamentally renegotiated so that it no longer serves as a secrecy jurisdiction or effectively as a tax haven. But it's not just the City of London. So the City of London is at the very center of a kind of a global network of tax havens that it effectively controls. And this is not just, this is primarily British overseas territories. Right, and the UK has jurisdiction over those tax havens, over those secrecy jurisdictions. It has the power to close them down. It has the power to introduce radical transparency so that we know where illicit wealth is coming from, and effectively put an end to those flows. But that's not a step that it has proven to be willing to take. Even though this has been a massive public scandal for some time, we're not seeing any real movements on this, despite politicians saying that they want to address it. So I'm skeptical that there is any progress, but let's hope that if there's a Labour government in the near future, that will be something that's high on their agenda.
Mm-hmm. Well, from what I understand, the UK authorities, for now at least, just intend to seize the assets whose origins cannot be explained, which looks like, to me at least, like a very good way of filling your own budget. But I wonder if we proceed from the assumption that that wealth is illicit, that it was stolen from the people, wouldn't it be more fair to transfer that money back to the countries of origin?
Yeah, so in the case of illicit wealth that's kind of stashed in London housing, for example, I mean, you know, what's at stake there is there's effectively a kind of tax evasion happening. The question is, where is that, right? Where is that tax being effectively taken from? The majority of illicit financial flows end up coming from the global south. And so what needs to happen is a repatriation of the trillions of dollars stashed in tax havens back to the countries of origin so that they can be properly taxed and benefits the local population where the production happened in the first place. That's certainly something that I would argue for, yes.
Well, let's hope the UK authorities heed your advice, but for the time being, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Dr. Hickel, for sharing your insights tonight.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.